Founders, welcome back to the Zero to 5,000 podcast, where we obsess over the convergence of human potential and business results. Today, our hosts Drew McClure and Jordan Mitchell have another insightful conversation for you. So let's jump right in.
All right, founders, welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with Justin Beals, co-founder and CEO of StrikeGraph, a fast-growing company that is all about security compliance. As a serial entrepreneur with expertise in AI, cybersecurity, and governance, Justin started StrikeGraph to eliminate the confusion related to cybersecurity audit and the certification process. Focusing on making arcane cybersecurity standards plain and simple to achieve and making employee growth top of mind, StrikeGraph has been set apart from all the competition. Along with StrikeGraph, Justin has a laundry list of accomplishments from being on three boards, winning 2018's most impactful startup during his time as CTO of NextStep and Koru, creating a patent, and even being an author. Here to tell us more and share his journey is Justin Beal. So Justin, thank you for being here, my friend.
Drew, it's a treat. I'm so glad to join the podcast today. Thank you.
Heck yeah. Well, we took our stab at articulating a little bit of your story as we understood it. But in your own words, how did StrikeGraph and you, how did this all get started?
Yeah, so I think StrikeGraph specifically got started because I saw a really painful problem in the marketplace. So when I was a chief technology officer, we found that our ability to close deals efficiently and get revenue in the door was hindered by one major challenge, and it was trust of the security that we had put in place. So here I am, I'm a chief technology officer. I built this really great AI product that will predict the likelihood that a job applicant will be a high performer. And we've got customers that are super excited about using it. We had customers like Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley, very high profile stuff. But for the product to work, because it was AI, we had to share all this data that was very sensitive. And when we got into procurement, they were like, well, you know, you've got a champion inside, somebody that wants to buy the product, they're happy enough about the price, but we're going to spend a year reviewing your security before we actually ink a deal. And I think, as you know, any startup like that, that is the death knell, right? Like, you're trying to bring the revenue in as quickly as possible.
Yeah, you can't wait a year for that to come through.
That's right. And as you mentioned, I love starting companies. I love building new products that solve problems. And so anytime I see a big problem, I'm always super curious about why is it a problem? Why is it such a challenge? How big a challenge is it? And so that led me to be really interested in the problem. And that led to founding StrikeGraph as a solution. Yeah.
So where did you start? You got that idea in your head. You see the problem. You know that problem exists. Where did you start to try to solve that?
Well, the first thing that I do, and this is probably a true motion for all of the solutions that I've built, is you want to find out how big and hairy the problem really is, right? So I started interviewing fellow companies around me to see if they were experiencing the same thing. And they were experiencing the exact same thing. You know, time to close on an enterprise deal can be 12 to 24 months. And I asked them, you know, where were you spending the majority of your time? And they're like, yeah, in security review. And they're asking us to go get all these certifications. But they'd be like, but we're a 10-person company. You know, I don't understand why we're having this particular problem. And so that helped me understand what the scope of the issue, like how big an impact was it? Now, the next thing, a little tenet of mine, is that I promised myself after starting a company as a sole owner that I'll never do it again. And so I really believe that, like, it takes a team to get these businesses off the ground. And so I was living and working in the Seattle, Washington area at the time. And there's some really great incubators in the area. And so I went to a group called Madrona Venture Labs, even though I've been a CEO in the past, and I said, hey, I want to incubate this idea with you guys and bring it to bear. And the team there were phenomenal at helping me round out what the opportunity looked like, find a co-founder in my chief revenue officer, Brian Barrow. And and once we had really drilled through the problem space and what a solution might look like, they provided some pre-seed capital for us to initially get a pilot solution off the ground. you know, along the way, one thing that I think is maybe new information for your audience and something that I find really important is I had no idea. Like, I'm not an ex-auditor. I'm not a compliance wonk. I'm not a privacy wonk. I was the experiencer of the problem and someone that was trying to solve it by delivering a product. I always, you know, you can be a deep expert in something and kind of miss the problem people are trying to solve, you know, practice the art of the thing instead of developing a solution. And for me to get savvy about what a solution would look like, I needed to do some really fast learning. And so what I tend to start with, and this is very CTO, is a data model, right? If I am a buyer of StrikeGraph's product someday, when I was at the incubator, I put myself in the shoes. How do I organize the information in such a way that our group can get our arms around getting through a SOC 2 audit or an ISO 27001 certification? And so that led to a database prototype of the solution, which we started selling early on as a pilot. Yeah.
I've never heard that before. It makes a lot of sense. Is there anything more specific if someone's listening to apply that? Like, what does it actually look like to build a data model like that would be helpful for you in that phase?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be super complex. Don't think I've got to write SQL queries. I sure didn't. I scratched it out on a piece of paper. And I'll use StrikeGraph as an example a little bit. So what we found is that there were a couple of pieces of information that were really critical to understanding if you could get an audit accomplished and you were ready to do it successfully. And for example, in our case, there were three main pieces of data. What risks am I trying to mitigate from a security perspective for my business? Then that will tell me what controls, and that's a security habit, I'm putting in place to operate inside my business. And then if I want to validate that the control operation has gone well, I need evidence. I need some type of receipt that shows that that happened. And I think what's critical to pull back there a little bit for those that are designing a solution are certainly the data. There is a risk, there is a control, there is a piece of evidence, but also the relationship between them. The risk is something confronting my business. The control mitigates the risk. The evidence validates the control operation. And then we had a real core tenet that almost anyone from an organization could come into and be like, okay, I can now look at a security posture and I don't have to be a compliance wonk. I don't have to be an auditor. I don't have to be a privacy expert and kind of understand what we're doing that we believe in. And so that gave us a core product to start with.
So it sounds like to a degree from a sales aspect, you are thinking through the problem, I guess, thoroughly enough that you are addressing every box you think that needs to be ticked, whether it's an objection or a fear or a worry. You're making sure that you're able to speak to all of that. Is that part of what that was solving?
Yeah. And to your point, once we got the basic model down and we could put a couple interfaces on top of it to test out how it worked, we started selling that as a pilot. And so now we're walking out to an actual buyer. And in a pilot program, what we did is very early on, we're like, give us a little bit of money. That proves that there's a value prop here. And we're going to teach you how to use our kind of system, our pilot solution. And what we were testing there as we were working with users was, number one, can a user that is not an expert understand essentially how to go and solve their problem, go get the audit accomplished? Can they create an organizational habit? Because we didn't just want to solve it for one person. This is a distributed practice. And so are they able to bring other teammates into the pilot program and work together on the software to solve the problem? And then finally, the most critical thing that we needed to learn was, will they pass an audit? And what stunned us is, like, the typical feedback from an auditor would be like, it takes 8 months on average to get through an audit. And we got our first customer through it in 6 weeks. And we were like,
wow,
this solution is really humming, you know, just in efficiency. We hadn't really wrote code. All the code we wrote, we knew we were going to throw out because it was very, you know, bubble gum and duct tape at that point. And so now we're starting to talk about really the value prop. Like, we're going to save you months at a time. You're going to be able to unlock revenue because you've got this certification that's going to open up your customer's willingness to buy from you. And so imagine you're a startup and you're looking at, it's going to take us 18 months to close a deal, or StrikeGraph is going to help us close it in 45 days. That is an immediate need. And I love that we solved a problem with revenue. You know, I do think that one of the critical questions that I had to learn to ask myself as a founder that has failed many times in the past is, really, what are people trying to buy and what problem are we solving deeply? And you can get out of your own head, or you can get too into your own head, I should say, and not in your customer's perspective. Our customers, they want to get a certification or audit so they can go unlock revenue. And we focus on that. I don't care about the art of compliance. It doesn't really matter to me, right? Like, we're trying to meet a bar, and that is good enough, especially for our customers. Too often, I would try and build products that were the art of what I was an expert in. And it's not what people wanted to buy. It was my ego driving the thing at the end of the day. And so I really highly recommend asking yourself a really simple question, which is, what are people willing to spend money on?
Man, I'm so glad you brought that up. It is still the thing. I this is why I have a question about it. It's hard for me to distinguish sometimes. I think anytime you are an expert or even more of a creative person that is passionate about whatever the thing is, I've found that same thing, that it doesn't always translate to be the product. It doesn't always translate to be the thing someone's willing to pay for. They see that as the problem, but you just geek out about the solution, or you geek out about the work, right?
Yeah.
What advice do you have to, if someone's a founder like that, to be able to distinguish what's the actual product versus what you just are passionate about, the art of the thing?
Yeah. Well, I think if you're really switched on, and maybe if you're, it's hard, like you're doing the pitching of what your particular solution is, bring a colleague into the room with you to be like, yeah, you lost them. They weren't really interested in buying that. Like, right about here, they were like, I don't necessarily care. And the other good signal is that we asked ourselves, what are people spending money on today? Are we like create? It's one thing to create a better solution in the marketplace for things that people are already spending money on. Then you know it's a real problem that people want to spend money on. It's a whole nother thing to be aspirational in your product, to believe that people will want to spend money on it, even though they're not doing it today. And I don't think that's a very viable, not a venture capital backed business that needs to accelerate its revenue like 3x year over year, because people aren't spending money on it today. They don't think they need to. They don't understand why they're going to have to.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about my own journey with this, and the way it applied is, I told you before we got started that I run a coaching company. And what I found is, if I was talking to a founder who already had a built-in value and belief in the need for their leaders and people to grow and develop, no brainer. Like, we connected super fast and we got their business. But if I was talking to someone who was on the fence, they didn't have a natural value for it, or weren't quite sure how to connect the dots, and I didn't know how to answer those questions, because my assumption is, of course you value this, and of course it's going to benefit the business, but I had no data to back that up. And so I couldn't speak to that. And I'll never forget just realizing, oh, I just need to go find those answers. I need to do some more research and be able to connect the dots of how this is not an expense, this is an investment, right? Because in that founder's head, you're just asking for an expense. And in my head, I'm trying to convince you this is an investment, that you put $1 in, you get $2 back, right?
Right.
And once I was able to speak more from that lens, instead of just a believer in development, well, then we were able to have conversations with both kinds of parties and say, hey, you know, this statistic came out from Gallup that every employee you're losing, it's costing you at least 50% of their salary. How much turnover do you have right now? We have a lot of turnover. Okay, what's at the bottom of that turnover? Are people dissatisfied? Are they burnt out? Are they not feeling like they're growing and evolving? All right, well, these solutions help that. Would that be valuable to you? I was like, oh, now we're cooking here, you know? But that was me learning to switch out of just the creative hat and the artist hat to the, what's the problem we're solving? How can we prove and demonstrate that that solves that problem? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you put yourself in your customer's shoes. You said in your headspace, your business has a problem. I'm here to solve that problem. Okay. That is something I'm willing to spend money on. You know, you asking for patronage for the art of coaching is not really where we're at as a business.
Yes. Yes. And that's what I realized is they were seeing it as an expense.
Yeah.
Like, all right. And some were begrudgingly like, maybe I need that to keep my people happy. But I was like, I need you to really believe this. Because if this is going to go well, you have to also support it yourself. Otherwise, it does not go well. It's not really implemented. It's not really going to get a return, you know, that kind of thing. And here, well, let me back up, because there's another question I want to ask you before we move on from this part of your story. How do you test assumptions? We talked about this a little bit, and I know you mentioned some ways, but is there a philosophy or a process you have? Because you started multiple companies. I'm sure you've been a part of multiple companies being started. That seems critical to me early on, that like you have an assumption of what the problem is, and then you have an assumption of what you think the solution is. How do you go about testing the assumptions? I'd just love to hear you speak to that.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that there are a couple of premises that will help. One is that you're always retesting almost the same assumptions. So the work is never done. And I think that that's a struggle, because probably as founders, we're passionate about getting on and building the business, right? And so you want to say, oh, I tested that assumption, it's resolved. But this is more like incremental inputs of data, revising where you're at constantly. Your business is dynamic, your customers are dynamic, the marketplace that you participate is in dynamic, is always changing. And so I think you have to walk in with a premise that you really just constantly have to be feeding in new data. And so treat that as a habit. Now, this is why I loved working with the incubator, because it's just easy for me to say, I do it all the time. I have a great VP of product that will be like, Justin, you like keep harping on this thing. I'm not sure I believe you yet. And so that's the second part of testing assumptions, is find people that will disagree with you and be open to listening to their disagreements and questions. The team at the incubator was like, hey, I'm not sure the TAM, the total addressable market, is as big as you think it is, Justin. Go get more data. You need to prove it harder for me. I'm not really, you know, this is not a brand new space. You know, compliance has been around for a long time. There are other pieces of software out there that do this. Why are you so different? And they were critical, hypercritical of me. And I needed to be open and invite that hard criticism and be a constant good listener. So I think there are some critical habits, even before we get to like, what is the methodology of testing assumptions, into like, you've got to be a listener. Harsh criticism is the best gift you can get. A customer saying no is a missed opportunity if you don't ask why. You know, if you don't give them the freedom and react kindly, you know, to that feedback, even though you hate it, because it's telling you what you don't want to hear about what you're doing. Now, each assumption, I think, starts to chart a little bit of a path. And so think about them as a journey. Our first assumption was people will buy our product. Well, that's an assumption. Will people buy our product? And so what we did at the incubator, right after we rolled out of the incubator and incorporated the business, and that was like February of 2020, our goal was to sign 6 pilot customers that would cut us a $1,000 check each for our pilot software. That was in shambles, right? Like, it wasn't in great shape. It was pretty piecemeal together. Well, we had 18 customers sign on in the first 5 months. And so now we've got a super strong signal, right? But the next assumptions are laying there for you to test. You know, can we build a robust product about this? What is our ideal customer? You know, sure, we got 18 people to pay $1,000, but will they, you know, what we wanted to have customers spend between 10 and 25? Would they spend that much annually on this particular problem? You know, how are auditors going to respond to our work? So don't think too far ahead in the questions, but be ready to ask the next set and use those really good habits and find experts and testing points in the field and just be super open-minded about listening to exactly what they tell you.
I love that. I mean, it speaks to me to the ego and insecurity that we all can have. I know I can have at times that would keep me from being resistant to the feedback or the person on the team that's saying, I don't believe that yet. And if I can remove that ego and remove that insecurity, it's incredibly helpful. I remember during the pandemic, and I have zero desire to get into any opinions on the subject itself, but I was talking to a doctor friend about, hey, how do you think about all the conversation that's happening right now? And aside from the conclusion, he was just saying the scientific process is not being done right. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, anytime we are evaluating something, we have at least one person in every evaluation that is supposed to be like an antagonist. Like someone is supposed to be sitting there going, I don't know. I don't think that's quite right in these areas. And he said, we've built that in because it helps us test assumptions. And he was just saying, it doesn't sound like we have that right now. Like everyone is saying the same thing. And he's like, just as a doctor, I'm wanting to know who's the antagonist in the room with Fauci or whatever. And again, I don't care about the assumption that maybe they got it right, maybe they didn't. But I took that in a business case and go, how easy is it for me to surround myself with yes people? Yes, that's brilliant. Yes, that's going to work. Let's do it. And not purposely inviting in the person that might go, I don't know. I'm not quite sure anyone's going to want that, and make you wrestle for it or fight for it, if you will.
The culture of founder worship that has been driven into our kind of tech industry doesn't help either, right?
Yes.
It's not appropriate for us not to have an antagonist there, a red team. And I think that really great contributors, whether they are a founder or a leader inside of an organization, look for those folks that are questioning them and they bring them closer.
Mm. Instead of when they discover them, they push them away.
That's right. Yeah. Right. Because it's easy to say, no, I just want to forge ahead. Don't kill my dream. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in all actuality, it's not your dream. It's an organization. It's a business. It's a sustainable profit making thing that you're trying to build. I always say our mission is value to our customers and taking care of our employees. It has nothing to do with me. Mm. And so I think it's hard for me to remove my ego. I enjoy being a CEO, and I enjoy having opinions, and I enjoy trying to go sell them.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's part of the passion, you know, in a good way that gets you to do what you're doing. You know, I remember hearing this guy, his name is Dr. Henry Cloud. He kind of got famous for writing a book called Boundaries. But he had worked as an organizational psychologist with many CEOs. And I just will never forget this phrase that he said, the most common problem that he saw them encounter was when they needed a necessary ending, but they couldn't see it.
Yeah.
And what he meant was, let's say it was a product, and for whatever reason, the founder had like an affinity for the product. It was the first thing they created, or it was the thing that they took off with. But the data was saying that product isn't making money anymore.
Yeah.
They would keep it around, but they didn't know they were doing that. They were still putting resources into something that needed to end, and they had to distance themselves emotionally and just say, hey, iPhone 1 is done. Like, yeah, let's no longer put, the market has shifted, or the company has changed, and I need to get rid of that and divert resources to what is working. And I just remember thinking like, wow, that is such a subtle problem where you don't even realize you have an illogical connection to something that if you were just to take a hard look at it, doesn't make sense for you to be doing anymore.
Yeah. I think to your point of not taking things personally or ingesting them in that way, we have a saying, I've used it as a CTO for a long time, and we use it at StrikeGraph, where when there's a disagreement going on or we're having a discussion about something, we say, look, we're here to work the problem, not the person. And I think that's really true as there's a difference between saying, hey, I'm looking for someone that's just antagonistic. What you're really looking for is someone that will dive in and and really discuss the problem with you. And so as we've formed our board for StrikeCraft, I've looked for colleagues that are working the problem with me. We are disagreeing on how to solve the problem. We are disagreeing on the best process. We might be disagreeing on how to test the assumptions that we're making about the solution we want to design. But at the end of the day, we're both deep friends. We have intense caring for each other as human beings, and we want the organization to be successful. And so whenever you feel like that red team is getting off track where the attacks are personal, or you're fighting each other or you're blaming someone, you know, we bring that back. Hey, are we working the problem or a person here? Because what we really need to be working on is the problem.
I'm going to take that. I'm going to give you credit for it, but that is such a great, reframe, because like you said, unintentionally, it can shift from now it feels like we're just attacking a person or we're being against just to be against instead of just being honestly attacking the problem. So I love that. My next question, I don't even know if you could fully answer for me, but I'd still love to hear you riff on it, is my interpretation or my observation is that data is only as good as your ability to interpret it, right? And so often I'm concerned as I'm gathering data that I don't know how to interpret it. And so like when I watch Shark Tank or you, I interview people that had 20 no's, you know, people told them no 20 times, yet their idea when it was finally believed in and invested in proved to be right. But they had 20 pieces or 100 pieces of data that was saying not a good idea, no one wants to invest in this. What also concerns me is if they were right and you kept trying to get this thing funded and those people were right, you know?
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm just like, how do we at least attempt to know what's misleading data mm-hmm. versus what is accurate feedback that we just need to accept?
Yeah, I think for our fund, maybe this is something that happens a lot in fundraising and dealing with investors. I certainly got a lot of no's. It's not good for us. But what I did is I listened to each no and why they said no. And for each no, I went and tweaked my pitch. So it was, you know, I really changed what we were thinking. If the no was, hey, I think there's a lot of legacy players in the marketplace, I'm not sure that it's really a viable spot for a new competitor, I would say, okay, I need to get more data on that, actually. I don't think they're fundamentally saying that the problem doesn't exist. They're not fundamentally saying that people won't pay for a solution. They're not fundamentally saying that we're not a good team to go and solve it. They're saying, I have a concern and I'm not reaching conviction about making a bet on your company. And could be that I dug into that space and said, you know what? They were right all along and the whole thing falls apart. But what I actually found was that, hey, I needed to be smarter about our company and opportunity to discuss it with them. And especially when you're doing fundraising, you're generally looking for one yes. But if you just sit there and go, all these investors told me no, and they're just jerks and they don't understand what's going on, you need to have compassion for the person across the on the other side of the table. Even if they're not super intelligent about your solution in space, they are doing their best to interpret what you're presenting to them. And so that no comes with an opportunity. Now, I used to tell myself, like, look, if we get a no and I go in and dig into the why, and things fall apart, then we need to stop. Like, we need to stop doing this because we're only going to hurt people. We're going to hurt ourselves. You know, we're going to invest a bunch of time and energy into this. We're going to hurt our reputation. We're going to go and get investors to put money in eventually because we just found the right person that didn't do enough due diligence. And that's going to be a challenge. And I like to talk, you know, when I'm working on fundraising, one of the things I always relate to investors is the investors that have been the best partners with us, the more time they spent learning about what it is we do and how we do it, the better the conviction and the better we work together long term to build the business more rapidly.
I love that. So we've spent a lot of time kind of in that early stage. All this conversation has been around that early stage of the business. And I believe that like kids growing up, the business grows and it has different challenges and, you know, different opportunities. What stage would you say Strike Graph is in now, and how would you characterize the stage it's in, and what challenges are being solved, or how are you thinking through the business as is?
Yeah, so we raised our Series A last year. With Information Venture Partners, we raised our seed about a little less than 2 years ago with Madrona Venture Group, who is a bellwether investor for enterprise software in the Pacific Northwest. They're a phenomenal group. It's funny. So I think our market is a little interesting, and I'll digress a little bit. So there's a common saying with investors that, like, once you go from seed and A into like a B, which is growth equity, what they're looking for is, they call it product market fit. And what I think happened early in our marketplace is that people found problem market fit. And so people were so willing to solve this problem because it's a revenue issue, that you could kind of throw any kind of solution up into the space and be like, look, we got a million in ARR. We have product market fit. And here's the investor hubris. They're like, yeah, that's right. That's our algorithm. You got a million in ARR. We're going to throw a bunch of money at you. Good luck. And now we expect you to grow into unicorn valuations, you know, from something like 3 to 5 million in ARR, which is just impossible, right? Like,
yeah.
You're trying to go from 3 million in ARR to 100 million in ARR at a 20x valuation to hit $1 billion, you know, in a year. Like, not even possible. And so they're losing a lot of money and a lot of valuation really rapidly, especially right now, as kind of our total tech investment economy is coming to grips with some of the bad bets that it's made recently. So what we said is that, you know, we want to take it just not slower, but more thoughtfully. And even though we really got to a million in ARR very quickly, almost more quickly than our competitors, we said, we're not going to take a massive round of cash because we still think we're dealing with problem market fit, and we don't yet have product market fit because we haven't learned enough, nor have our competitors. And so right now at Strike Graph, where we're at is, we do think we've crossed the product market fit realm. We will have, at the end of this quarter, we'll have 3x'd our business over last year's Q2 quarter end.
Wow.
We're 150 plus customers. It's grown like a rocket ship, and we are able to talk about our solution in a way that our competitors can't really touch. And so I think that we had a little bit of pragmatism early. We didn't do the super fast Silicon Valley thing where we just kind of dive in with a lot of capital and say, if we throw more salespeople at it, we'll have a great business. We said, hey, there's some fundamentals that matter. And to give you an idea of how critical that is, our net revenue retention last year was 115%. So while we still experience churn, our existing customers upgrade motion added 15% to our balance sheet.
Wow. All right. I want to talk about this a little more because I was having a meeting with one of my clients last week, just checking in with her. What's going on? Where's your head at? And she said, I'm really concerned at some of the stuff that's happening in the tech world. I said, what do you mean? And she turned her laptop around and said, I'm watching these sites that just popped up that are literally tracking live the amount of tech companies that are folding right now, or at least experiencing down rounds and those kinds of things. And I said, well, I don't know that world. Tell me about it. And she started to explain a little bit, which I'd love to hear you talk about, but that overvaluation, that like looking to throw money at things. And I was like, oh, kind of like Rivian. And she was like, exactly like Rivian. And I don't know that much about it. I just remember hearing about the evaluation that Rivian got and hearing certain people on podcasts be like, that is like 10x what even Tesla got, and they haven't even produced anything yet. And so if you could just talk to that for a little bit, and not just, you know, to throw people under the bus, I just want to learn from it. One, I want to know what might be happening in case, because she's only tracking it to see what implications it's going to have on her business.
Right.
And then she's like, man, I might also buy up some of these employees that are now out of a job and whatever. But you also mentioned your thinking that I think is so critical, that you were getting the fundamentals right instead of just taking as much cash as someone's willing to give you and hope you'll figure it out along the way. And that might be a curse in some senses.
I think it's a big problem, actually.
Okay.
It's this, and it, look, I mean, we've seen this story play out with like WeWork, and I just watched the We Crash thing, and it weighs heavy.
It's my on mind. My list. I want to watch it.
Yeah. And the medical device team in Silicon Valley that just crumbled, you know, yes. they never actually built a real product. They just had vision. So, and look, I'll point the finger a little bit. I think Silicon Valley is really responsible for some of this ridiculousness from time. And look, you and I are both from the South, and we have a saying, you know, you don't F up the game. You know, right. we all got to like live in this environment, in this marketplace. And that means building solid companies with good fundamentals that can grow rapidly. I mean, don't get me wrong. We all want to grow, but it doesn't help to essentially fake your way there. I'm not for that. It doesn't help anyone. And where the real impact is that when an investor comes in and wants to invest money, they're going to create a valuation for your business. So they're going to say, I'm going to invest $10 million in your company, and I'm going to value it at $50 million. And this is buying me 20% of the shares in your company. So let's say that you were a company with $5 million in ARR, $5 million in revenue, and a company said, I'm going to give you $100 million of investment. I'm going to value that at $1 billion so that I can get my stake in you. But I'm speculating that you will someday be worth $1 billion. It's not really what you're worth today. And to actually get there, there's a multiplier on the revenue that kind of equates what that valuation will be. It's generally been about 20x, but it fluctuates. There were times where it was 100x when cash was cheap, but now it's way down. And some of these just SaaS businesses that are churning customers left and right and essentially aren't, you know, getting the growth effect that they need are down to a 6 or 7x valuation on their particular revenue. So now you're a company, you raised $100 million in cash, but you're burning $50 million a year. You've got to reach $100 million in revenue at a 20x valuation to meet that $1 billion. So your next round can look like more valuation than the one in the past, but you can't do it because you, even with 100 million, you barely got above 20 million in revenue. And so now you're going to take a down round. And then guess what happens? Those investors that invested in you before, their $1 billion fund is now worth half as much because they were saying that their fund was worth so much because of the valuations that they were setting on the companies that they set them for. None of this is good for business.
Right. Explain that part to me, because I had heard that term before, but it wasn't until she walked me through a very similar string of events that I even understood what a down round was.
Yeah.
And why that even matters. Like how that then begins to affect the business when things are worth less and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So a down round is this. Let's say you get a round, you raise $10 million and I'm using round numbers here to help me. You get $10 million and you get valued at $100 million. You go and try and use the 10 million in revenue to grow your revenue, but it doesn't go as high as you had hoped. Now you're still underwater. Your business is not making more money than it spends, and you have to go raise more capital. Now your valuation is going to be less than that 100 million. So everyone that was not only hoping for you to be worth 100 million, but more, predicting that you would be, all those investors, they see you're now worth 60 million. So now you're worth less money to them. And they're more concerned that you'll never grow out of it. And it gets much more expensive to get that cash in the door. And so before you know it, as a founder, you don't own very much of the company anymore. Neither do your employees, because you're having to give more of it away to get the basic capital that you need to continue operating and trying to grow. Now, there are companies that take a down round and then turn it around. And sometimes it's a very strategic choice. Like, we're making a significant pivot. We need to take a down round to keep running, but then we're gonna get on the backside of this and get a higher valuation. But it's right. Hard. It's not easy. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I know there's been specific times for, you know, unique reasons that someone does that. But it feels like right now, just a lot of people are getting caught with their pants down, and
yeah,
that's tough.
And investors that I talk to are looking at unit economics again. What's your gross? Some of the stuff that mattered to me when I ran bootstrap businesses. What's your gross margin? You know, how long until you make more money than you spend? What's your ACV? What's your churn, you know, of customers? What's that net revenue retention look like? Is there an upgrade path?
How fundamentals.
Fundamentals, yeah. And I'm so glad to see it. Yeah. I'm so glad to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's always painful when it happens, but hopefully the end result of something like that is it produces better businesses. That
exactly.
It forces, I mean, again, not happy at all about any of the ramifications of COVID, but one of the things that at least it did to all the business owners I know, it exposed any weaknesses.
Yeah.
Just like a virus does. A virus will expose, did you have an immune system issue? Did you have whatever? And, you know, the restaurants that I know that were like operating on a 1-3% margin were like comfortable with that because business as usual is just enough to keep the lights on. And then that disruption ruined it. And it forced people to go, if I'm going to own a restaurant, how do I get better margins than that? Because I was too vulnerable. Any disruption really took me under. And I think the same thing right now in investors and with tech companies, one, we got to get better at doing this business if we're going to succeed, right?
Absolutely. And look, we all sleep in this. Like, this is our market. It's where we operate. And when we create an environment where people don't trust each other, it is much harder to build great companies that really solve problems. And so it frustrates me when the speculation is so high that no one can really achieve it, but they're just doing short-term things. You know, like, look, investor dollars should never be a revenue model. Just stop celebrating you got the biggest round, right? Like, I don't really care. I care more about the strong business that has got a great solution that the customers are happy to pay for year over year, and the one that can take the least amount of investment. I mean, isn't that an intriguing idea?
Yes. Well, I can't remember who wrote the article, Forbes or somebody, but they were talking about this idea of like the flattery metrics and distinguishing between what's the flattery metrics versus what are the essential metrics. And we keep talking about and presenting to our customers these flattery metrics that don't really tell us if the business is any good, doesn't really tell us if it's going to be here 5 years from now, or if it's even adequately solving the customer's problem. We need to know the metrics that we should be paying attention to, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I would ask that of investors. I'd ask that of founders. You know, if you're starting a company, like, you know, think about the business. That's what your goal is here, to build a great, valuable business, not to just go raise capital.
Yeah. Well, my company is bootstrapped as well, which makes sense, especially being kind of in professional services. It's not software. It's not tech.
Yeah.
But, you know, our first few team members, just excited about growth and about us, kept pushing me and my co-founder, like, let's take money. Let's take money. And my instinct was like, I have no rational logic that tells me more money is going to solve anything right now.
Yeah, that is a great way to approach the problem. Yeah.
I need to know why more money would accelerate the business beyond the temporary influx of cash that it's giving me. Like, I don't think we figured this out yet. I don't think we figured marketing out yet. I don't think we figured out who our target customer is. And so more money is not going to figure that out for me. I want to wait until I've got something that I can look at and say, yes, more money will cause that thing to grow and expand. And that makes total sense to me. But I was like, guys, I'm not going to do that. I have no rational reason to believe this is going to actually increase our business beyond we felt really comfortable for 2 years while I'm not feeling comfortable. Because as the founder, I'm going to be watching that money go away.
That's right.
You know, like, you're going to feel great with your paycheck, and I'm going to be watching that account get lower and lower and lower over the next 2 years, right?
And, you know, when you take that time to build up some of those fundamental metrics, the company is valued higher. So dollar for dollar, you're selling less shares of your business for the same. So you take $1 million, it's a 5% stake instead of a 20% stake.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're already getting close on time here. I have loved this conversation. This you've You've greatly increased my business IQ. So thank you so much for this. Before we get into the lightning round questions, just five quick questions we ask every founder. I do want to ask this because I want to make sure I ask this every conversation. Are there any books in particular that are just a favorite of yours that you would recommend to our audience for? It could be life, it could be philosophy, or it could be business. Anything that you've particularly enjoyed or benefited from?
A book I've read recently that I really liked and I've shared a bunch is 1491. And it's about the state of the Americas prior to Columbus landing here. And what's really, it just blew my mind reading the book. And I always find that, you know, to your point about assumptions, like we make too many, and I like getting a deeper detail, but there was probably the population size in America was much bigger than we ever imagined. And disease could have killed as much as 80 to 90% of that population in the Americas. And it's just mind-blowing me that some of the archaeology and the science work now, and this book, 1491, does a great job of kind of bringing some of the latest research into an understanding about that. And so it reset my assumptions on, you know, the past and what may have transpired, especially in as we're dealing with a global pandemic, and what impact it could have had, you know, on humanity. Yeah,
absolutely. I'm going to check that out. I love those types of books. So glad I asked the question. All right. Five quick questions. We won't go into detail. They're lightning round. So first thing that comes to mind, number one, if you can ingrain one message into your entire organization, what would that be? Almost like a billboard that your team has to walk past every day.
Immediate value to our customers, take care of our employees. That's our mission. Yeah.
Love it. All right. Question two, what is the single best advice you've ever gotten about growing your business? And also, what was the worst advice?
The best advice I ever got about growing my business is make sure and say your differentiation like three times in a row in every pitch. The worst advice I think I ever got was to make a rash decision to take poor customers.
Makes sense.
Take a customer, they're a big customer, but they wound up being a lot more painful than they were.
Similar to taking cash when you don't need it.
Yeah.
All right, question number three. What currently causes you the most stress or worry leading this organization?
I think the number one thing from a stress perspective right now is making sure the value of our product is front and center in consumers' minds as they're searching, as opposed to just marketing. What I stress about is people that are making a buying decision in our marketplace that are comparing us against other competitors, being like, oh, I saw a billboard, instead of saying, oh, I should go look for the best solution for me. I am most stressed about...
They might take the first available versus actually having done research and find the best available.
Yeah. And so that's a problem for me, which is how do I make it easy to understand why we're differentiated and valued more highly?
Love it. Yeah. All right. Question four, what's your BHAG for this business? The big, hairy, audacious goal.
Oh yeah. We want to reach 100 million in revenue in the next 3 to 5 years. Yeah.
Heck yeah. Number five, if you could hop into a DeLorean and you get to go back to your past and you get to tell yourself just one thing, when would you go back in your past and what message would you deliver to that younger version of yourself?
Yeah. I think I would go back to right after I finished my theater degree in college and was trying to decide what to do and be like, hey, you know that tech stuff that you've been loving since you were a little kid, like keep sticking with it. So, which I did, thank goodness, but it would have been nice to have somebody give me some confidence.
Heck yeah, man. That has been such a common piece of advice that I'm learning from every time. It's usually there was an instinct that we either ignored or were told to ignore that we wish we had listened to sooner, you know?
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Justin, thank you so much for sharing your story and your wisdom. Like I said, this has been truly valuable to me, so I really appreciate you being on.
Drew, it's my pleasure. I suck at lightning rounds, by the way. I want to talk too much about each topic. These are great questions. All right, good. I love that we got a chance to talk deeply about some of the things that we can improve about our marketplace, and appreciate you hosting a conversation that, you know, provides a counter to some of the assumptions that get made. So thank you.
Heck yeah. Thank you, friend.
Founders, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and hop into our monthly founder email so we can ensure you stay on the edge of peak performance and massive business results.